Hey everyone, this is Tim Schlitt, partner and co-founder at Palo Santo, a psychedelic-focused venture capital fund, and you are listening to Professionally Psychedelics.
Hey there, listener, and welcome back to the Professionally Psychedelics podcast. Today, I am really pleased to say that joining me on the pod is Tim Schlitt, co-founder and partner at psychedelics VC firm Palo Santo. The psychedelics industry has experienced growth at a breakneck speed over the past 2 years, with swathes of groundbreaking research and cutting-edge companies looking to revolutionize mental health treatment as we know it. With over 20 companies across their portfolio of psychedelic pioneers, there is absolutely no doubt that Tim has a direct lens on the latest innovations in the space and the type of companies that are driving these forwards. I really cannot wait to get cracking here. So, without further ado, Tim, welcome to the Professionally Psychedelics podcast.
Great to be here with you. Really appreciate it.
It's great to have you with us, Tim. And as you'll know, our first and customary question on the pod is, what led you to the plant or the plants?
Yes. So I'll try to keep it a short story because that alone could take up the full hour, I feel like. But I'll start with my professional career and that background. I mean, have been in the healthcare ecosystem throughout my career. So did banking at Green Hill & Company, which has a very active life sciences practice. And then later on worked at Madison Dearborn Partners, a Chicago-based private equity firm, which is very active in the healthcare services space. And certainly that was the main vertical that I was operating in. So have always had my eyes on healthcare and more importantly, just through personal passion, have always been tracking mental health and the latest innovations and treatments in the mental health space. So it was about 4 years ago that I started to see a lot of the data emerging from Johns Hopkins, NYU, Imperial College London, you name it. And having come from a bit of a life sciences background, went, holy crap, this is really, really interesting. Now that we're in humans, we've moved beyond animal models and we're seeing clinical effects like we were seeing in decently powered studies, I would say. I went, wow, there's something to at least look at here, you know? And then the Michael Pollan book came out, of course. I think for many, that was a big phase shift in the industry and in a big piece of the adoption curve as well. They got a lot of folks bought in, of course, read that. And through that exploration, finally gained the comfort and confidence that, hey, these are, at least as it relates to psilocybin, certainly, these are pretty much safe when done under the guidance of a trained therapist. And they're incredibly efficacious as well for a range of things, be it, you know, depression, I think trauma, PTSD, you name it. So certainly after a lot of exploration, a lot of research, gained enough comfort and have to say, you know, through some guided experiences, found these profoundly transformational. So I don't like to suggest that clouds my view or my judgment as an investor, but I certainly think informed the view that these will really be transformational to medicine and psychiatry in particular. And so that kicked off this long journey that led me to co-founding Palo Santo, which is a VC fund focused on trying to allocate capital to the best players in the space. I think the folks that we think will be the best at advancing these medicines to patients in an affordable, efficacious, and accessible way.
And Tim, when we talk about the psychedelics industry, especially looking at it through the lens of an investor, for you, what do you see as the core sectors of this space as things stand? And perhaps as an extension of that, how do you expect this to change? How do you expect this to evolve over the coming year, the coming 2 years, as the industry, research, and companies all alike mature and develop further?
Yeah. I'll give my I'll walk through the verticals, and then I'll probably splice in my blunt commentary on what interests us and what doesn't interest us, quite frankly. But I think a lot of what we've seen over the past few years have been primarily biopharma plays. So drug discovery operations that are either working with pretty well-known compounds, but they may have their spin on them, whether it's a polymorph or a salt form that they think they can achieve patentability around, and also maybe a novel indication that hasn't been explored. But beyond that, a lot of folks working on what we call NCEs, so new chemical entities, novel drug discovery. I think you could more widely characterize this space really as serotonergic-based drug discovery, but many are targeting the primary receptor and source of what we think is efficacy, which is the 5-HT2A subtype receptor. So it's one of the subtypes of the serotonin system. So that is one big vertical, and I think it's been the main vertical. It's also been a vertical that does appear to have imploded a bit, I would say, in recent history. If you look at public markets, both psychedelic companies, but not just psychedelic companies, biotech more broadly, is down by a similar percentage to a lot of psychedelic stocks. So we can get into the nuance around why that's the case and why I don't think that means biotech is dead in the water and that there's nothing there. But that's the main vertical. I think beyond that, you know, certainly some folks have looked at what I would characterize as manufacturing. So creation of API, active pharmaceutical ingredients, and really the drugs that will be used in trials and eventually more broadly for patients once these are approved. That's a vertical that hasn't quite frankly interested me, but certainly one that has been explored in the past. And then clinics, and I'd say more kind of consumer-facing applications that can be quite wide-ranging, that can encompass things that are really medicinal, like as we currently see ketamine is offered off-label, all the way to more in kind of a gray area like the Oregon market, and maybe other jurisdictions that will legally open up. But there's that sort of consumer-oriented, you know, consumer-facing clinic-type play to things, which is really a services angle to the space. Again, I can hit on some of the reasons why that doesn't completely interest us. It more has to do with just that the fact that those are difficult to scale and make profitable. And then the last thing would be tech as well. I think there's a lot of tech applications that will overlay the infrastructure of these therapies as they roll out, be it patient monitoring, tracking, data capture, EMR, EHR, you name it. I think in the tech space, there's some debate about what really needs to be labeled psychedelic. It, you know, it can kind of become like what AI was if you just slap it on because it's a sexy term and can bring in the money. But, you know, certainly I think there will be some tech applications, and we're invested in a number of companies in that space, like Kasana Health, for example, which is very focused on passive, ongoing patient data capture.
And Tim, you mentioned before about a couple of sectors that don't interest you. And actually, as an investor, I'd really love to pick your brain here about the sectors that for you guys don't quite hit the mark or aren't quite of interest, aren't quite going to pique your interest. I'd love for you to walk us through some of these and perhaps talk about how you and your team really approach analyzing investment opportunities within the psychedelic space.
Yeah. Well, and happy to start with the first part of what doesn't really interest us. You know, what's been interesting is there's been this whole picks and shovels thesis around what I would really characterize as CDMOs. So, you know, development, manufacturing, operations. You know, in that space, I've had experience investing in drug manufacturers. It is much more commoditized, I think, than people think, for one. And in addition to that, you know, again, it's just not a classic VC type play. I don't think they really, you know, there's not that exponential growth that you'll see in and really scalable growth that you're going to see in other verticals. Also, there's a lot of CDMOs out there. So back to it being commoditized, you know, someone doesn't need to necessarily be psychedelic focused in doing that. So that on the manufacturing side, I haven't seen anything that is incredibly interesting. And the other component to that as well of why, you know, why we're not quite as interested is I think a lot of people talk about, well, we know how to manufacture psilocybin at half of the cost of what, you know, chemically derived psilocybin may be. We certainly see LJ derived psilocybin or E. coli is another one I've heard, or yeast based, you know, you can go down the whole list, but I don't think that's the real pain point in terms of from a cost standpoint around these therapies. I think the much bigger pain point is the duration of the trip, the amount of psychotherapist time that is required to administer these. That's where you're really seeing the cost balloon. So our focus in the space, I think, is really more on the drug discovery side, where if you can develop novel chemicals, novel compounds that could shorten the duration, or it's certainly a controversial topic, but could you be leveraging similar mechanisms to traditional psychedelics, but without the psychoactivity? I think that's solving a much bigger pain point for the space than bringing down the cost of API, which isn't really going to move the needle that much. So, you know, that's one space. CDMOs, kind of API manufacturing, all of that doesn't really, we don't love it. We, you know, we've certainly looked at opportunities and we will, and maybe something interesting will emerge, but just haven't seen a reason to place any chips on, you know, on that part of the table. And then the next one is clinics as well. I think, you know, the big question with clinics is, are those really a proper venture capital play? Are they really more like a traditional private equity play where, you know, it's unit, you're thinking about expanding, you know, multiple units. It just, the scalability isn't quite in the VC realm that you typically see like for tech or other type of verticals. So that's been one big question, has been certainly scalability around clinic-based models. But the other big question mark has been whether these are incredibly profitable operations either. I think in the ketamine space, I've said this multiple times across a number of panels, but the dirty secret is that ketamine clinics aren't incredibly profitable. I don't think a lot of these clinics will get more profitable as you add on therapies that are even longer duration and make the workflow even more complex. So, you know, not incredibly scalable businesses. The unit economics aren't really intriguing on those. So those are certainly the verticals we stay away from. So, you know, as you can tell, the main focus of the fund is certainly biotech. And I think part of that is that's just RMO. That's where we certainly can excel from a domain expertise standpoint. So there's a bit of just finding your edge in this space, and that certainly is ours. But beyond that, you know, the way we evaluate opportunities to really boil it down to the key pillars of diligence, it's tech, it's team, and it's commercial plan. So I guess I'll start first with team in the middle there, but it is really helpful to see operators who have been in biotech previously. I think a lot of other industries lend themselves quite well to having disruptors on board, and, you know, outsiders come in, they shake up a space they've never been in. You know, Uber is the classic story of that. They had no one from the transportation industry. But what's interesting, and that does seem to be a successful model in a lot of different areas of VC investing, but it kind of flips when you're in biotech. The base rates would suggest that it's something like 70 to 80% of successful biotech startups have had a CEO and a C-suite with prior biotech experience. So there's just so much regulatory nuance in this space. There's so much technical nuance as well when you're developing a drug. It really is much more valuable to have a background within biotech. So we like to see teams that have come from, you know, they have a nice pedigree in the biotech space. Ideally, they've filed INDs. Not ideally, we would definitely want to see folks who filed INDs with the FDA and even NDAs, you know, in an ideal world, that they've taken some drug to market previously and successfully. So team is a critical component. Then commercial plan is another piece, and I think that's twofold. One is that there's an economic model on the back end of commercializing a therapy that does make sense and ideally would be insurable as well. I know that's certainly a big topic of debate in the space, but also that there's strong intellectual property around an asset. I think, you know, IP, also a dirty word or controversial topic in the psychedelic ecosystem. I can understand some of the reasons why. The tough thing as a biotech investor is that the cost to get a single drug to market, and this is just for a successful drug, is probably at least $200 million, you know, upwards of $200 million. I think Spravato, I've heard, in the $200 to $250 million range. I mean, it's a very capital-intensive operation. And then you're also in an ecosystem where there's a lot of failed drugs. So the aggregate cost can be far, far higher. I mean, there's figures thrown out, you know, even upwards of $2 billion when you account for failed drugs. That's the cost to just get a single successful drug to market. So if you're going to front that much investment, you want to make sure on the back end that there is some ring fencing for a period of time around the molecule you're developing. Otherwise, you're going to see a freeloader problem where a bunch of generics just pile on. They leverage all of the R&D investment you've made. They don't need to make that investment, but they reap the reward. So IP is a very strong piece, and we try to be pretty buttoned up in our IP diligence. And then the last thing and the most important piece would be tech. And by tech, I mean, you know, what is the data to support a molecule depending on the phase of development that molecule is in. So of course, when you're in preclinical, there's different, you can almost imagine a decision tree of assays that will get run, generally starting with preliminary in vitro assays. So using cell tissue lines and collecting a variety of data there. Eventually you'll move to in vivo. So testing these in animals for both pharmacokinetics, but also you'll begin to evaluate animal behavioral data. And then eventually you'll file an IND application based on that, a big component of that being toxicity in animals, making sure you don't observe any serious adverse events in animals. And then from there, if something's clinical stage, of course, trying to see what's coming out of the human clinical data then and whether you're seeing a signal there. And the last piece I'll layer on to all this is you aggregate all those pieces, you know, tech, team, commercial plan, does the valuation make sense? I think there's a lot of folks for a long time who are pointing to Compass a tie and saying, well, hey, we're 50% of Compass's valuation. Look, this is such a steal. Now I think they're feeling burned by that since Compass's implied enterprise value is like $10 million, something like that. So it's come to bite a lot of people in the butt. But that aside, you know, if you're early stage, if you're preclinical, the risk profile on the asset is significantly higher. So that risk should get priced in, and it should be a much cheaper asset versus an asset that is in the clinic, and especially if it's an asset that's gotten a clinical readout of some sort. You know, what we are starting to see is phase one readouts where they'll have some representative patients, and that's where GH research really took off. They had something like 8 or 9 folks suffering from depression. They did see a signal from 5-MeO-DMT, and that was enough to get a lot of the big life sciences investors in. So a lot of it will depend on phase of development and does the valuation make sense in light of that. And we certainly walked away from opportunities where it was just the valuation was pie in the sky and it just didn't make sense, even if there was some, the other pieces were compelling.
And talking about that risk, you know, when we're looking at really complex research and science and often really early stage research and science, in what way can investors, well, truly understand the scientific potential of an organization and the strength of their IP, the strength of their proposition, you know, what they're looking to achieve perhaps 5-10 years down the line? Sort of, you know, who is your lab coat person on speed dial? How are you sort of really getting under the bonnet, getting under the hood of whether their science, their thesis makes sense to sort of carry on the dance with?
Yeah, a lot of credit does go to our scientific advisors. I mean, I would maybe describe internally at Palo Santo, we're conversant on the pharmacology, but you know, Chuck Nichols, John McCorvey, folks like that are proficient, is how you could characterize it. So we leverage them a lot, and they are some of the best, if not, I would personally argue the best in the space around especially 5-HT2A research and understanding the pharmacology underlying that receptor target, which is the main receptor target for classic psychedelics. So, you know, a lot of what, again, it depends on stage of development, you know, so that'll certainly determine what you evaluate or how much you can evaluate. Some of the initial components of evaluating a drug are just looking at on-target effects, off-target effects, you know, determining what is your disease target, what do you think the pathophysiology of a disease is, and then just validating, does your molecule even, does it have affinity at those receptor targets? So a lot of what you look at initially is Ki affinity at a variety of receptors. The main ones will be, of course, you want to see a signal at 2A, if that's your hypothesis of what's driving the, you know, the underlying pathology. But then, you know, some of the preliminary weed out criteria are, a lot of folks are now trying to weed out 5-HT2B liability. There's certainly been a number of drugs like fenfluramine that were even pulled from the market because folks developed valveopathies in a rare number of cases, but it did seem to be a risk. So 5-HT2B activation certainly can be a risk factor. There's debate around 5-HT2C, whether there's utility, whether maybe there's an anxiogenic quality to that that might make trips a little bit jarring for folks. You know, there's certainly debate there. But then beyond that, you look for, you know, there's a variety of off-target effects that you'll want to avoid, like alpha receptors, for example. At least if you're hitting those, you're going to want to start to look at heart rate, blood pressure, those pieces of the puzzle. HERG inhibition is a major, major risk. You know, ibogaine, even though it's not a traditional psychedelic in its mechanism, that's one where hERG inhibition really, that's the rate-limiting factor on commercializing that therapy. But hERG is something we see with a lot of molecules that folks will try to weed that out. And then certainly, I think Chuck or John could speak much more intelligibly to it, but there's preliminary data points you can pick up on, you know, for liver toxicity, you know, hepatocytes. You can use that to determine, is there, you know, or would there be any potential organ damage from a drug. So it's, you know, kind of on target, are you hitting your disease target, off target, making sure you're not hitting receptors or targets that would be deleterious to the subject. Those are certainly a lot of the pieces. And like I mentioned, as you go down the research rabbit hole and as the compound gets later and later, you will start to leverage more animal behavioral data. There's a variety of behavioral assays, again, depending on your disease you're targeting, that may be loosely indicative of a therapeutic effect. But I want to hedge that by saying, you know, animal behavioral models, especially in as it relates to neuropsychiatry, have a very difficult time translating. So we certainly haircut those, but they can be informative. The only one that is very, very informative, there's a strong correlation that we know around, is the head twitch response assay. And that assay, Adam Halberstadt out of UCSD has done a lot of work on this. He has shown that where you are registering a head twitch response, it's a pretty reliable indicator that the molecule is psychoactive in any mammal, and that will translate to humans. So depending on whether you're trying to screen for something that you want to be psychoactive or you don't want to be psychoactive, depending on, again, what you're targeting in the commercial profile, head twitch response can certainly be informative.
And Tim, when you're putting together a portfolio of companies operating within this space, how much of your decision-making process is geared towards creating a really sort of complementary cohort of companies that are operating at perhaps different points of the value chain? Or perhaps is the thought more just to go for the cold hard winners that you can see out there? How much of your decision making is looking to bring together complementary businesses, or are you really just looking for the companies that you think are really going to generate the best returns and also sort of social good? How are you approaching this here?
Yeah, I mean, to your last comment there, I do think social good and profit can go very much hand in hand with many of these therapies. I mean, if these are much more efficacious than SSRIs, and can be rolled out in an accessible manner, I think there's a lot of good done for patients that where there's an incredibly high unmet need. You know, some folks are certainly focused on the value chain and they want to cover every vertical. Again, I think the reality is there will be certain verticals within this ecosystem that just don't generate that much value for a variety of reasons. Like I said earlier, like contract development, manufacturing operations. I'm not quite seeing the opportunity there like other folks see it. So we don't think about it as much that way. And admittedly, that might be a bit of a cop-out answer. Some of the real answer also is just, I think where we're really cut out to vet opportunities is within biopharma. That's our niche at Palo Santo. Other folks may be much better in other verticals, and more power to them. You know, we don't, this ecosystem needs more capital from all corners. And I think everyone has their own expertise to bring to this industry. Ours just happens to be in the biopharma space. And then within biotech, I would say the way we like to think about that is there's a few different ways to cut it. You know, if you're a purist about psychedelics, you would argue that the only a true psychedelic has to be a 5-HT2A agonist. Anything that doesn't do that isn't really a psychedelic. So for some of the purists, they'd weed out ketamine, ibogaine, you name it. I think the reality is the way we define psychedelics, you know, more colloquially or, in the general public is a lot looser. And we certainly lean more towards that definition at Palo Santo, that dissociatives, compounds that can induce a psychoactive type state, even if it's a very different mechanism of action, we're certainly interested in. And there's value to that because a lot of it, when you're doing biotech investing, one big way to de-risk a portfolio is to bet on multiple mechanisms of action. So rather than just putting all your eggs in like 5-HT2A agonism, in case that hypothesis doesn't pan out, at least you have hedges in the portfolio that there are other promising mechanisms out there. So ibogaine, for example, is a kappa opioid receptor agonist. Ketamine, it's an NMDA antagonist. Very, very different receptor targets, completely different underlying mechanisms. And it's a nice way to have an uncorrelated basket of companies within your portfolio. So we certainly strive to do that. We have exposure to ketamine through both Atai and more so Gilgamesh, I would say. Certainly exposure to ibogaine or ibogaine-like molecules, as like in the Gilgamesh case. So that is one way to think about the portfolio. I will say, with that all said, we do have a lot of exposure to 5-HT2A agonism regardless. You know, that is the main underlying hypothesis in the space around the disease target you want. So that's a lot of what companies in our portfolio are looking to target, but in very different ways. And the reason why we're okay with taking exposure there is that I think there's still a lot we have not elucidated about the underlying mechanism at that receptor as it relates to downstream chemical signaling pathways, even more so neurologically, you know, from there, what's going on in the brain, in what regions, you name it, you know, there's a lot of talk about neuroplasticity. There's so much that has yet to be learned that our bet is this probably will be an interesting target. What will be the most interesting way to hit that target, we still don't completely know. And we want to have, you know, we want to have our eggs in a few baskets as it relates to that. And that's certainly what we're doing. We're in companies that are, you know, that will be long duration, highly psychoactive trips. where in others where they'll be highly psychoactive but shorter duration, and maybe that's sufficient to get a clinical effect. Where in other companies like Delix, where there seems to be no psychoactivity, for example. So we're certainly, you know, in terms of diversifying risk, that is another way that we do it, even as we're putting quite a bit of eggs in the 2A basket, is to say, hey, there's a lot of different hypotheses around how to target 2A, how to register efficacy, and we'll place bets in who we think are the best companies targeting those different areas.
And for investors who are invested already in psychedelics, or perhaps are looking at investing within the industry, what sort of time frame would you say a psychedelic investor would need to be comfortable with that is realistic for seeing results from, you know, return on their investment? What are people looking at? What are average or projected returns? And are there opportunities for investors who perhaps are more looking at quick returns in this space, or are these all long-term projects?
Yeah, so it's interesting you bring that up because, you know, your time horizon is you're talking about shepherding a molecule through the clinic all the way to commercialization. I mean, from IND filing through phase one, phase two, phase three, that's probably a 7 to 8 year journey alone. And then if you layer on the preclinical component, if you're doing some novel drug discovery, that could be upwards of 10 years before you see a drug hitting the market and the asset actually generating revenue and more importantly, cash flow, I would say. So that's a component where people go, holy crap, that's such a long time horizon. Too long for me. There's risk. It's too long. Don't want to place a bet. The reality within the biotech ecosystem is generally once you get a phase two readout, which will be your first, the first time in the clinic where you're administering a compound in human volunteers who are representative of that disease, you know, who are or meet the diagnostic criteria of that disease. It's the first time where you're putting it in and then getting a readout and seeing if you're hitting your endpoint. Once you get a phase two readout, an asset is pretty de-risked. I mean, there's about a 70% likelihood that that asset will make it all the way to market at that point. So that translates pretty well into phase three data and then eventual commercialization. So within the biotech value chain, and I'd say capital markets value chain, generally, once a company gets a phase two readout, there's quite a bit of precedent to be able to go public. A lot of big pharma companies will start looking at it as a potential acquisition target or even a licensing candidate, you name it. So, you know, what we were seeing prior to 2022 was that timeline compressing even more. And in some cases, companies with a phase one readout going public, as we saw with GH Research, for example. I think that in the current capital market, with the current capital market backdrop, that is not the case. So that's going to extend out again, and I think it will take longer for companies to really see a time horizon to monetization of someone's investment. But with that said, given that that's a real catalyst in a company's journey that de-risks the asset, I do still think a phase two readout, there's a lot of ways to monetize that asset in some way. So for investors, if you're getting in, you know, let's say late stage preclinical where the lead candidate has been at least selected, you're kind of doing your pre-IND work, that's more like a 5 to 6 year time horizon until you could see an asset, you could see liquidity on your investment, which is right within the normal bounds of a standard venture capital investment if you were doing it in tech or, you know, consumer, you name it, other verticals of VC investing. So even though the timeline to commercialization can be quite extended, in biotech, the timeline to monetization of an investment, I do think falls within a pretty standard venture capital framework.
And Tim, you mentioned about the markets earlier, and of course, sort of the public markets, but also looking at individual industries themselves, there is no hiding from the fact that sort of markets have taken a bit of a battering, at least in the last few months in 2022. Compare this to last year, where sort of with a specific lens on the psychedelic industry, was a real boon year for the industry. Companies fundraising all over the shop, values quite high. To what extent does the sort of suppressed market state at the moment, to what extent is that an issue for the industry? And perhaps sort of looking at investors themselves, are there new opportunities that you have identified resulting from us coming from the back of a really heated market last year to things being a lot cooler at the moment.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, you had to bring it up. I was opening my TD Ameritrade account as you were going through that. There's a lot of red in there lately. But yeah, I think, you know, 2021 was a boom year, not just in psychedelics, but even biotech more broadly, I'd say. And then you started increasingly throughout the year, you started to see a slow sell-off. I mean, biotech really, really took off through the pandemic, and you started seeing a slow slide. I will say, with this all said, there's certainly a lot of things are, you know, trading or it's receded to around 2018 levels, roughly. So, you know, it's kind of coming back to like a pre-pandemic norm. So it's not like it's imploded even further relative to where that norm was, but it's kind of sliding back to where kind of the steady state was or maybe should be in terms of pricing. Since there's so much biotech exposure in psychedelics, this space has been no exception. My read on the psychedelic quote-unquote implosion, if you could call it that, would be that it does seem to correlate pretty cleanly with the slide in biotech. So I don't know if it's anything idiosyncratic to psychedelics or if it's more so just a biotech falling out of favor, you know, kind of a cycling out. And then add to all that mix, you were already seeing a bit of a sell-off. And then with the Fed pulling back, funding risk, financing risk in biotech is a very, very big risk. So as you see monetary tightening, you know, you can have good assets that don't get funded just because there's not enough money to go around. I think a bit of that is getting priced in. Some fear around that of, holy crap, what if people can't even fund a clinical trial just because there isn't enough money in the space to do so. So that affects biotech companies. Of course, that'll affect psychedelic biotech companies. That's kind of been my read on it. You know, there's been a little bit of emerging debate of will these be as efficacious? You know, what are going to be the commercial limitations? But I don't think we're quite at like that trough of disillusionment that everyone talks about in the Gartner hype cycle. I think a lot of that trough has been more just macro driven than quite frankly idiosyncratic to psychedelics. So that's been my read on the market situation. With this all said, I think what you're going to see in our bet at Palo Santo is, it's not like the whole space is going to wash out or it's not going to wash out universally. I think you're going to see a bifurcation. I think the companies that are very undifferentiated, for example, MindCure, we know folded. I'm blanking on, there was another one alongside them. I don't know why the name escapes me right now, but there was another psychedelic publicly listed company that folded. You know, I think companies that are really undifferentiated, that they're doing the 10th spin on MDMA or Ibogaine or you name it, there's not going to be really a moat built around those businesses. I think a lot of those will wash out. But the good companies, I think folks working on new chemical entities where they've got really good data to back it up, they've got good scientific or clinical teams to shepherd these through clinical trials, I think those companies still will survive this. I think they'll still win out. You may see valuations compress a bit. But for us as an investor, we don't mind that. I mean, we still have quite a bit of our fund to deploy, a little north of 40% of the fund to put to work. So we're putting money to work in a market where valuations have gotten far more attractive. But our thesis and our confidence around the space really remains unchanged. So we welcome the buying opportunity. And I think there's going to be a nice bifurcation. And last thing I'll say, also, this has been a thought that's been in the back of my head. I've actually never articulated this on a podcast or panel, so you're the first to hear this. But, you know, there's been a lot of debate around IP and the intellectual property landscape getting very crowded in the psychedelic space. I think what will be interesting, you actually may see a beneficial case where a lot of these like ankle biters with intellectual property just wash out, and the IP landscape doesn't actually get as crowded as people were fearing it would be, since you just won't have a lot of companies with any funding or their fold and in whatever weak IP they hold, they can't even file a lawsuit against anyone because what money do they have to do it with? So I think that actually will be a benefit also, that some of us were getting scared of like this emerging bloodbath of everyone starts suing everyone else over IP and overlapping claims. But you may actually see less of that if potential competitors just don't even survive to be able to do that.
Talking of competitors and looking at the time here, our time is coming to a close. So Tim, I'm going to throw a final barrage of questions at you, if that's okay.
Go for it. We'll go rapid fire. happy to do that.
So yeah, so looking at the landscape of competitors, obviously there are companies in the industry who are competing against each other, but of course, investors and other investors alike, of course, compete. How does that sort of competing versus collaborating piece differ between the space you find yourself now investing in psychedelic companies and the handful of good investors that are in this space as well versus your previous hats and previous lives investing outside of psychedelics?
Yeah, and this kind of speaks more, even more sort of why I love venture capital over private equity. It's much less of a zero-sum game. You know, in any round, a syndicate generally needs to get filled. And so you need a multitude of investors funding around rather than one person just taking the whole show. In private equity, it's whole company buyout, leverage buyout. It's kind of one person wins a bidding war, end of story there. So much more competitive to buy out assets and invest in companies. So more broadly in VC, that's always what I've loved. It is a much more collaborative ethos. A word I've really liked, and this actually credit goes to, there's a really good book that just came out relatively recently called The Power Law by Sebastian Mallaby, and he uses the word co-opetition. It's about the genesis of venture capital and kind of the storied history of VC in general, you know, the emergence of Kleiner Perkins, Sequoia, all those folks. And it's how that, you know, they compete to a degree, but they do need to cooperate. Like maybe I'm investing in the seed or the series A, but at some point someone else is going to have to invest in the B or the C in that company. And you need to maintain a collaborative relationship there that folks want to come in. Or, you know, if we lead the A, that you need folks to fill the syndicate alongside you. So there's certainly been a collaborative ethos, I think even more so generally in the psychedelic space, in that, you know, for even a single company to get a drug all the way to market, if you take all these psychedelic focused VC funds collectively and what my general sense of what their AUM's around, I think even all of us combined could not fund one company all the way to commercialization. So we certainly know that we all need to collaborate. We all need to fund these companies together. And it's not going to be a winner takes all market from an investing standpoint. So certainly collaborative. I think, you know, the only cases are in situations where there's a major breach of trust. If someone, you know, violates NDAs, things like that, we don't want to deal with bad actors in the space, and we won't. And we just completely veer away from cases like that. That is very rare, but I think we've certainly observed it. And in those cases, just from a pure business ethics standpoint, there's not enough hours in the day to work with people like that. So love collaborating with lots of folks in this space, and that's generally the ethos, and always give everyone the benefit of the doubt unless trust has been breached. You know, then I think you blow your chance when that's the case. Or if trust has been breached multiple times and there's multiple cases of a pattern of behavior, you know, won't work with people for that reason. They just don't want to get tangled up in that.
In investing, as in any other space, yeah. And
yes, as in any other, we see it in all corners of VC. Yes. It's been interesting in this one for some reason. In all other corners of VC, you know, bad actor behavior seems to come to light a lot more. This is one where it doesn't, and I'm not sure why, but kind of everyone knows it. So, you know, yeah, we work with great people in the space, and give kudos to a lot of the names. I mean, Vine Ventures, for example, love what they're doing with MAPS. Neokuma, I think, great fun.
Oh, brilliant.
Love how they diligence opportunities. Remind, you know, Eater Investments. I know Eater, Negev quite well. I mean, great, great folks. Ambria, like the list goes on and on. Love working with all these folks. Integrated, I think, incredibly mission-aligned folks. Lionheart. So I'm listing off a lot of names. Like, we love to work with all these guys. I think they're incredibly ethical. They've got their hearts in the right place. And we all collaborate in a lot of ways. So want to give a shout out to those names. And I apologize if there's any that don't immediately come to mind. If I missed any names, that's probably not deliberate. But I think it speaks to the fact that we work together with a lot of these guys, and I really admire the work they all do.
No, that's great to hear. And Tim, one final question, just because you touched on something earlier that I'd love to pick your brain on. You mentioned about leading funding rounds. Now, for you and for investors in the space, what would you say is the key significance of leading a funding round?
Well, from a practical standpoint and a legal standpoint, one will be setting the terms. So setting the price of the round and what it's valued at and the value that all other investors will come in at alongside you. It almost will always come with board representation. So the fact that you take a board seat, you have some governance and oversight in the affairs of the company, so you're quite a bit more intimately involved. And I think to a degree, being a cheerleader, I mean, a lot of the onus does fall on the company to fill the syndicate and cheerlead for themselves. But you're certainly giving your stamp of approval that, hey, we have done, the most diligence on this opportunity. We think this is the right valuation, and we're going to put our stake in the ground on this, that we think this is a really valuable opportunity. It's certainly a statement of that. And I think a lot of investors will look to the lead to leverage their diligence and leverage their insights. And so one thing I'll say to companies is your lead investor, I think even your cap table is really important. Not all capital is created equal in any vertical, any industry. And really being mindful of that, of who's validating, who do people trust. I think that's a really important piece. And sometimes valuation isn't what wins the day. Sometimes you can, if you're viewed as enough of a validator or lend enough credibility, you can come in at maybe, terms that may not be the best on the table. But if you've got a good relationship with management or there's other softer factors, that can win the day. And I think that's the best place to be as a VC investor.
Perfect. Well, I think that is a lovely place to round this off. And that is great as well, because the clock has beaten us. So what I'd like to say is, Tim, thank you so much for joining us on the Professionally Psychedelics podcast.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me on, Jonathan. Really appreciate it.